So, any starting points?
I'd just like to know, how would you define yourself? The difference between you giving a talk and you rambling?
You don't notice any difference.
He doesn't know. Do you see what I mean? Because your talks at the London Buddhist Centre, we call them ramble.
Yes.
I
don't. I've thought out what the theme is, but I haven't decided what I'm going to say.
Okay.
So I think it's through working in India. I've just got used to talking on the spur of the moment, and although it's nerve-wracking, and it sometimes fails. I don't catch the wind, as it were. I often find it far more creative. And so I've increasingly not prepared beyond getting a broad idea of a theme. So that's what I mean. I sort of used it as a trade name for a particular approach to entering into a situation. Now, sometimes I do prepare a talk, but often these days not.
Can I ask you something about your latest thing?
Of course, yeah.
About initiation to a new...
Uh-huh.
You say, I don't have numbers, but I think it's the... revisioning the ordination ceremony, you say at some point, by the time someone is accepted for ordination, they will have formed a special connection with one of their Kalyana Mitras, who will play a leading part in the final stage of preparation, especially as regards the five aspects, and who will act as their private preceptor.
Right.
Did you mean official Kalyana Mitras, or do you mean spiritual friends?
I just meant spiritual friends, really, not necessarily official Kalyana Mitras. Of course, this is an idealised model, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's what I meant, that, you know, by the time somebody asks for ordination, you would expect that they, if this sort of model becomes active, you'd expect that there'll be at least one order member with whom they felt a Kalyana Mitra relationship, and who it would then be natural to ask to ordain them. That would be the ideal situation. You remember that I'm the first generation that conducted ordinations after Bante, and Suvadra and I used to be given a list of people to be ordained. He would take A to J, I would take K to Z. And usually we knew them all because they'd been in the ordination process which we were running. But we didn't have special connections with them. Gradually we've moved towards a much more organic connection between the preceptor and the person being ordained. So what I'm anticipating in that paper is that relationship developing further. So pretty much what probably happens by and large now, but just making that more conscious and taking it further. But I don't see it as, that they have to have an official Kalyana Mitra who then becomes, etc.
Because that's how I read it in the first place, which made me a bit confused about it.
Yeah, I can imagine. There are probably lots of things that, I was trying to sort of make a bit more explicit what Bante had talked to me about, and sometimes I may have not hit the nail on the head.
Thank you.
Yeah, good.
I have a question from the same paper. When we discussed it in our chapter, we wondered about one moment you mentioned that anything should be possible for people to make a connection with the transcendental, instead of when you talk about the nature of silence, people losing the silence or like these things. you say something on the line that everything is possible, but people inspire them to make a connection with the transcendental. And I was wondering, how far do you go with that? Do you only limit yourself to the Buddhist tradition, or can you accept someone who say, I have something with Led Zeppelin, Stairways to Heaven, or something like that?
Very, very interesting question. I think in the previous paper on imagination, that's where I said that in principle, anything that's contemplated could be a gateway to, we'll put it that way, transcendental realization, non-selfhood. But as I said in that paper, following what Bhante had said to me, certain objects will more naturally lend themselves to that insight. So that for instance, you could, you know, we focus on particular Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as embodiments of the Buddha's enlightened experience. So what are the limits of that? Well, Bhante discussed this with me in terms of what he called discernment of spirits. This is a term from Christian mystical theology, apparently. I have come across it before, but in the Christian tradition, you need to know the difference between a vision that comes in the form of, say, Christ or one of the saints. You need to be able to tell, is this really Christ or is it the devil appearing as Christ? Because the devil is infinitely cunning and he can appear in Christ-like form and lead you. Well, we won't even go where he leads you. So according to Christian mystical theology, you need to be able to discern spirits. You need to be able to tell whether they are the real coinage or counterfeit. Cervantes said that we needed something like that sort of intuition, that spiritual intuition, that you can tell that this particular image or object, in the broadest sense, is really for you or for that particular person a viable gateway to spiritual death and rebirth. What he then said was that he thought that we probably should not exactly be cautious, but you know, we can rely on the image of the Buddha. You can rely on the figure of the Buddha. For instance, if you're talking about concentrating on a figure, you can rely on the figure of the Buddha. You can rely on certain images from tradition. Beyond that, people who have some capacity to discern spirits will have to sort of look into it. I haven't put all that very well, but do you see what the sort of area I'm pointing to? So potentially, theoretically, anything could provide a means of realization. But some objects, whether of a personified form or not, are going to more readily and unambiguously lend themselves to that than others. So the image of the Buddha is very clearly related to a historical story, to particular teachings, to his teachings. It's very clear who you are meditating on when you meditate on the Buddha. You know who he is. You know what he stood for. You know what he means. You know that this figure embodies realization of impermanence, insubstantiality, and the unsatisfactoriness of everything conditioned that is clung to. You know that. So you know how to relate to that figure. But you when you extend beyond that figure, it becomes less clear why you're choosing it, what motives are mixed up with it, what ideas are mixed up with it. Does that get anywhere near what you're getting at? Yeah. Yes. So it's. I think this is going to be the difficult thing for us to work out as a community, is allowing forms to evolve that come from people's real spiritual experience, but without allowing that to become whimsical or ideologically led or just confused. That's going to be the balance to strike, so that what is meditated upon is genuinely a gateway to spiritual death and rebirth. We've got a certain sort of armoury, I was going to use that unfortunate term. We've got a certain set of classic objects of contemplation, but in a way we don't want to be confined by that. At the same time, we don't want to be distracted into just choosing, you know, at whim.
What does that mean, at whim?
On grounds that are not really
vague, or
yeah, vague or a superficial liking.
Okay.
You know, to be trivial, you contemplate Tara because you fancy her, sort of thing, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or you know, you're sort of attracted by the you know, like the demonic figures. You're attracted by them because of a rather superficial idea of I don't know, the dark side or something like that. It's not necessarily that Tara or a demonic figure in certain cases couldn't be valid, mm-hmm. but if the reasons are artificial or shallow, then well, that may very likely will prevent you from really relating in the right sort of way. So it's a delicate balance, isn't it? You don't want to choose too much from a personal basis, because the whole point is going beyond personal choice. But at the same time, you don't want it to be so far outside it that there's no real connection, no feeling.
Just checking, the answer to me seems to be quite the same or similar lines as how you find what is valid teachings and what is not.
Yes.
It is Buddha's advice to Mahaprajapati.
Yeah, yeah.
What the Dharma really
is. Yeah, yes, indeed.
The difficulty, of course, is together with your spiritual friends deciding what really leads to this question and all the question and those things.
Yeah, well, it's no different. It's exactly the same issue, yes. Yeah. In other words, the criterion in the end is, does it work? Does it have that effect? But one isn't always the best person to judge that.
What is insight?
What is insight? well, of course, Bhante speaks of it more in the terms of the recent papers, in terms of spiritual death. So insight is the recognition in experience of the insubstantiality, the lack of reality of separative selfhood. So in other words, it's the getting rid of innate and acquired attachment to self. That's fundamentally what it is, and it's completely related to spiritual rebirth, which is the experience of what transcends that. In other words, selflessness. And of course, in traditional terms, insight is spoken of chiefly in terms of insight into insubstantiality, impermanence, and the lack of satisfactoriness of any conditioned thing that is attached to as an object of clinging. But all of that really means that you experience letting go of self-attachment and opening up to selflessness. But one of the important things is that insight is not merely cognitive. The way we often talk about it is that as if it's a sort of quasi-intellectual realization. But a according to standard Buddhist theory, the problem lies deeper than the conditioning that we have within one single life. It's dealt with in the Yogacara in terms of innate and acquired wrong views or kleshas. So acquired ones we gain in this life. It's the ideas that we have from our culture, the attitudes that we develop from our childhood conditioning, from the society around us. But deeper than that is something that's programmed into us. Traditional teaching would say because of our past conditioning in previous lives. One might also say because of the biological evolutionary conditioning that we carry with us. So the organism itself is set up to see things in terms of a really substantial I and a really substantial other. So it's deeper than mere thought. It's deeper than mere patterns of attitude. It's something absolutely rooted in the structure of our perception. I appear to me to be here, separate from you over there. It's the way it's set up. And that won't change, but insight means that I no longer identify with one pole rather than the other. But I think it's quite important to recognise that the change that insight generates is far deeper than merely getting rid of cultural conditioning or personal psychological conditioning. It's to do with changing one's relationship to the very act of perception itself.
It's understanding?
It's understanding, but it's understanding, of course, necessarily privileges the cognitive aspect. So it's emotional as well. You could say it's an emotional understanding, although even that is susceptible of misunderstanding. But things are exactly the same, but you no longer feel attached to this aspect of it. I mentioned this morning that brief experience I had giving a talk in Nagpur, which was, because it was in vivo, it was in the action, was particularly sort of striking experience for me. It's as if at that point I was no more identified with myself than, I didn't go into the crowd either, I was identified with a whole field of consciousness in a completely unself-conscious way for a little while. So it's to do with the change in your relationship to the very basic perception, the very emergence of perception. So it's understanding, but it's not understanding in the narrow cognitive sense. It's not emotional, because that's, as it were, too shallow. But I think it's quite useful to think of it in terms of a changed relationship to perception itself. The moment of experience. And that's why it's a far bigger job than it often appears to be. And why I think it's so important to have, as well as the meditative and contemplative dimension, the engagement perspective, so that you're drawn into an active engagement with people, especially people, so that the way in which you attach to one side of the experience is challenged, and also you're drawn beyond it. Very difficult to challenge yourself.
Talking about that, I was thinking of how can we do that in Metta Vihara? Because,
That's what I was wondering, when we could explore that a little bit. You said this morning about, you know, having a vivid, I don't exactly remember the words.
Mm.
How can we, as an order,
use
or, I don't know if it's the right, make the best of this place in relation to our own practice and in relation with, well, developing friendship in Kalyana Mitra. That's something we have started thinking about as well before the opening. How? So I don't know the answer. So I have the feeling that we have to find the answer together.
Yes.
Because we don't have communities here, we don't have white livelihood team-based white livelihood businesses. Most of us live. We don't know. We have no people living together in the order. So
no, we don't. We do now.
Well, you do. However, you do. So could you say something about what you think could help us to develop that aspect?
This is I've another set of conversations with Bante that I have yet to write up, in which I've been exploring that a bit. To me it seems, first of all, the issue is of recognising that what we want to bring about is that sort of vivid interaction, is my current cliche for it, that sort of, coming together in such a way that you collectively go beyond yourselves, individually, collectively go beyond yourselves. And then trying to look at the forms for that. I mean, this is the question you're asking.
Yeah, really.
But I think it's so important to recognise what we're trying to do. So often, I think, in the past, what's happened is the discussion has got polarised around community or not community, marriage or not marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, those all are pertinent, but in a sense, they're secondary.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the relationship between commitment and lifestyle. Commitment is primary, lifestyle is secondary. So it's a bit the same sort of issue. Secondary, but not unimportant. So I think we need to start off with a recognition of what we need to achieve, what we want to achieve, in terms of a certain quality of interaction. And then trying to see, by discussion and conversation, exactly as you say, to work out between us how best that comes about. But first of all, there needs to be a desire for it. And I think in the past we've got over-attached, me, I have got over-attached, and others too, to particular forms of bringing that about.
Mm-hmm.
And then you lose sight of what the purpose of that is.
Mm-hmm.
And the plain fact is, you know, a lot of the forms that we use actually don't work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we can focus on what it is we want to bring about, a certain quality of interaction that is... very definitely to do with something beyond us as individuals, that is value-laden, and that is honest and open. In other words, that we're bringing ourselves as we are. We're not coming together as idealized beings, so that there's a relationship between the real and the ideal that is healthy. That's what... In a way, this is as far as I want to go. I think we need to have a sort of a shared recognition of what we want to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a way, we honestly need to say, well, I want to achieve that. Anybody else want to? How can we do that? And, you know, if somebody's free to say, well, I want to some extent, but frankly, you know, not beyond a certain point. You know, we need to be honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can't give much time to that, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think you need to sort of think about the forms that will work. And I think it's all the forms that we've had until now are intended to do that. But we need to keep on checking that they really do. So do our chapters actually bring about that sort of a vivid interaction? Are they the sort of arenas within which a sense that we're more than ourselves as individuals without losing ourselves as individuals? Does that really come about? We work together in centres, for instance. That's, I think, a very powerful medium for this sort of interaction, because you're trying to do something for other people, and you're trying to bring about something that's valuable to them. So the quality of your connection with each other is a lot of what brings that about. So I think questioning what we already do is very important. But I think starting to ask more, what more can we do to bring about this sort of atmosphere, to call it that, this quality of... it's more than communication. It's something, almost something that is felt beyond us as individuals, but it's not separate from us as individuals. Which I think probably in a project like this, you get a very strong feeling for. The physical project comes to embody or symbolise something more than the project. And, you know, I can tell from the atmosphere that was generated by this. What do you do now? I'm sorry, I know, I'm just repeating your question back to you. But I'm sort of quite... I'm a great planner and a great theoriser of practical solutions, and I'm trying not to do that these days. I'm trying to stick with the...
No.
I'd only get it wrong. And in a way, it does have to be worked out in activity, in the lives that people are really living. You know, again, you know, recent debate about, you know, single-sex communities, married life, and so forth. You sort of feel we're not really talking about the real issue. We're talking about subsidiary issues, which are not unimportant for that. They're not being talked about in the context of what is really important. In which, you know, pertinent things can be said about the value or the lack of value or the advantages or disadvantages of lots of different ways of interacting. So I'd like to sort of... I'd like to myself pause for a while at, you know, seeing what spiritually is valuable for us and for the world that we want to bring about. Looking at the institutions that we have got, looking at the interactions that we have got, seeing what's worked in those institutions, what's not worked in those institutions, and starting to think about, well, maybe this could be explored, maybe that could be explored. So, for instance, you know, in the Low Countries, there are quite a lot of you. You've got various interactions. That's what I mean by institution, by the way. I mean sort of channels that are established. I don't mean institutions in the sociological sense, or maybe sociologists use it like that, but sort of patterns and channels that are already formed in an existence. Well, what in them is working? What is not working? What could work better? What might be made more of? What might be made less of? Where do opportunities lie that have not been availed of yet? So in getting this together, I think you probably stirred things up a bit. That's a bit of an impression I've got from a distance. That the Sangha has come together around the creation of Metta-Vihara, that the Order Sangha has come together around Metta-Vihara in a way that it hasn't for a while. I think almost all of Order members in the Low Countries are here, but from one or two.
Only Sagara is not here.
Yeah.
Can you see it?
She would have been
here. Yeah.
She would have come.
Yeah. So, well, that hasn't happened for a long time, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe ever. So that must mean something about this particular project. Mm-hmm. So it'd be quite good, actually, you know, something one might do in days like this is sort of sit together and think, what made us come together here on this particular occasion? What was it about this project that caught our imaginations, that drew us into a coming together? What were the factors in it? So I'm trying to stay more at that sort of stage of inquiry. I burnt my fingers too many times laying down the law. And, you know, rightly. I think we're a mature community now. and a lot of experience amongst us, and we ought to be drawing on that more fully. So I think it'd be very interesting for you in the Low Countries to have that sort of inquiry, have a debate amongst you.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, let's see whether we share that sort of idea of a certain quality of interaction. I don't know what to call it, but this particular sort of consciousness that is more than us as individuals, but that doesn't negate us as individuals, this third order that comes into being. I thought it was here this morning. You could feel it. You feel yourself just sort of opening up and softening up. And you feel quite confident that everybody else in the room, or most other people in the room, are there with you. Starting with that quality, that comes about, like everything else, independence on conditions. Some of those conditions are entirely personal to us as individuals, our personal practice, our blah, 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 blah. But what are the collective conditions? And how might we extend those? For instance, obviously the project itself has inspired people. I suspect the name has been inspiring. I was meaning to talk about that, but I think Metta itself, Bhante's argued, hasn't he, that there's a forgotten teaching implicit in the Pali Canon, but it's fairly clear that in the Pali Canon, the Buddha at certain points is talking about metta as a transcendental experience, in other words, transcending self-clinging. It must be. Generally, in the Theravada Vipassana traditions, metta is talked about as very preliminary or a side issue. But actually, if you're really experiencing metta, there's no self. It's selfless. It must be conducive to insight. Really, the fifth stage of the metta, properly done, is insight. It's spiritual rebirth. It's spiritual death and rebirth. So I think that the word metta already has a concept which has a life to it, a vivid spiritual life to it that has drawn people together. So, yeah, then I think it would be good to have a discussion about how you use this place.
Yeah.
And how anybody who wants to contribute can contribute to it. I was very struck at the LBC. Maitri Vadri, principally, but with the help of others, has organised a team of volunteers. They have 70 volunteers, who all of whom do something every week. It's astonishing. So they man the reception, they clean the toilets, they do some of the bookings, they help out with office work. They do lots and lots of things. And it's very, very powerful medium. And meeting with the volunteers, they were all expressing their great gratitude for the opportunity to volunteer, because they sensed something so valuable here, they wanted to contribute to it. Not as I will give, but they wanted to be part of it. But I asked Maitri Vadri what the sort of secret of success was. And she said she's got a threefold formula. First of all, invite people to participate. Secondly, train them in what you want them to do. And thirdly, appreciate them. So I think that's actually very good sort of sangrahavastus. They all almost could be a new sangrahavastu set. First of all, for order members, we order members also need inviting. You invited me so positively, and you made me feel so much that you wanted me here, that I tiptoed in with great delight. I was only at Akashashuri, nobody else. yeah, you know what I mean? I felt absolutely delighted to be here, and I felt I was wanted. Then I was trained in what to do. Akashashuri.
You're going to follow slaves.
Absolutely. I told her I would do whatever I was told. She gave me strict instructions, for instance, about the metta. I'm just going to do exactly what she told me. And then I'm sure I'll get lots of appreciation afterwards. Seriously, it makes a big difference. We need invitation, training. We need to be told, well, what we want you to do is this. This is the way you can best contribute. You know, of course, sort of allowing room for personal creativity and all the rest of it. And then, I think collective appreciation is extremely important. So I think that probably with a project like this, there are some who are necessarily in a sort of coordination position. And perhaps for them the chief issue is to invite participation and to inquire of people what they can contribute, what they want to contribute, and then to find ways in which they can, the training as it were, that aspect of it, and then just to make sure that collectively there's an atmosphere of real appreciation, which doesn't have to be uncritical. That's the training part of it. So I think that probably to get this working effectively, you're going to need a lot of input from everybody. Yeah. And the more order members who are actively involved in making this this work, the more, the better this will work, but also the more the order will be drawn together. It's a bit vague, but I hope that's helpful.
Thank you.
Well, I think it's quite interesting, those three points from Maitri Vajri, because I don't know, it just popped into my mind that Gampopa talks about three aspects to develop friendship in the jewel ornament in the chapter on friendship. And he talks about, first of all, you need to approach people. So it's like inviting.
Yes,
and the second one, he says, when you have approached someone, you really have to meet. And he said, and then often that's where it stops. And then afterwards, people don't do the most important step, which is honouring what's happened.
So
you're talking about
appreciation.
Interesting.
Good. It's got commentarial reference.
So I've got sort of not quite related question, but it seems to me that the Sangha jewel, I mean, this is a statement, but it might not be right, but that seems to be undervalued in most Buddhist traditions, as if it's not been as important as the other two jewels. And it's almost, that's my personal feeling, that I find that one of Bendy's, most important contributions to actually bring out the importance and value of the Sangha jewel. Not just the transcendental Sangha, but the nitty-gritty bit. What did you say in the article in the paper? The sharp edges are gone through the project.
The which, sorry?
The sharp edges have smoothed through the project.
Well, I suppose, the impression I get, and Bhante's more or less said this, is that what he's done is make it more explicit. But I suspect that traditionally, when the Dharma is really alive, it is valued. It has been valued. You can clearly see it in the Pali Canon, and you can see it at various other points. You see, Milarepa with the Ripas. there clearly is a Sangha there, which is appreciated. So I suspect you get, as in all fields of Dhamma life, you get a period of a really fresh, genuine experience where everything's alive. And that will include a strong, vivid sense of, see, I keep using this term vivid, a strong sense of this, the importance of our interaction with each other. But then that, of course, it becomes embodied in forms and institutions necessarily, they're necessary to it. And then eventually those institutions become more important than the spirit that originally animated them. So you get continually this dialectic between fresh, authentic, genuine, creative experience, its formalization necessarily for better communication, and then the ossification or fossilization of those forms, which then has to be refreshed with new understanding and insight. So I think that's one process that you can see. A lot of what we see in the traditional Sangha is, I think you could even say, past deadness. A lot of it. But you do see in areas of the Sangha worldwide, you do see something much more genuine and fresh. So you've got that process, the inevitable, necessary movement from fresh, authentic experience to form, to dead form, and then renewal. It'll happen. It's happened in our own history, even in our short years. It's happened a number of times, and it will happen a number of times more. And one day, it will happen to the point at which somebody has to kick it all over and start again. Hopefully, I was going to say God willing, but you know, hopefully, if we all do our stuff, it will be a long time. Of course, that process is greatly, the process of ossification is greatly accelerated when there becomes a question of official recognition, when, in other words, a clerisy arises, when the state and the spiritual community become mixed up with each other, or social, the social structure becomes mixed up with the spiritual community. You can see something of that in India, so that, you know, that an order member has a social standing which has nothing to do with their spiritual worth. That more difficult then to keep it alive. We're fortunate here that being an order member has no social standing at all. In fact, almost the reverse. But yes, that process, that dialectic, I think is continuous, and we need to be very conscious of it and not fear it. It'll happen. But if we keep, you know, if somewhere somebody keeps on, you know, a definite, a genuine spiritual practice, and some people keep in genuine, vivid interaction with each other, it'll refresh. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect, of course, is that the Dhamma is always related through the cultural circumstances. And it seems as if there's not been a need, much need, in Buddhist history to more explicitly explore the significance of Sangha. It's been sort of assumed or experienced. It's not been necessary in the circumstances to spell it out. But Bhante's mentioned this in relation to the question of friendship and spiritual life. But it's never been much talked of because there wasn't a need. People naturally experienced friendship as an aspect of their lives which deepened with spiritual life. So I think that Bhante's drawing out of the significance of friendship, the significance of Sangha, is particular to the problems of our times, and maybe particular to the experience of anomie that goes with our times, the experience of alienation and of failure and collapse of community. It's very interesting amongst the gypsies, because they have a very strong feeling of community. And I incautiously, injudiciously, said something about the group with our usual, you know, tone of voice, as it were. And I realised I'd said completely the wrong thing. They love their group. And their group is for them, their security, their is where they're accepted. So you have to find another way in, if you see what I mean. You can't, in a way there, the question is almost sort of using their positive experience of a group. They have a positive group to some extent, to some extent. There it's a question of sort of drawing that out further. So does that get at not the question, but the discussion point that you made? I think that's the phenomenon that we've got. As in many, many areas, the Dhamma has entered radically different circumstances to any other time. They're not merely different in the cultural sense. They're different in social structure, political structure, and economic structure. We live in totally different times. I think it really is different to any other transition that Buddhism has ever made, because people's relationships within society are assumed differently. We take for granted, at least here we do, you don't in Hungary, we take for granted democracy and a democratic rights and freedoms, which then alter our relationships to each other. Our, as it were, abstract relationships as citizens are almost as important as our blood relationships as family members. Our economic relationships as consumers, as units of consumption, so to speak, and as independent units of consumption. They alter our relationships to each other. Our assumption that individual choice is more important than family structure, for instance, alters our relationships to each other. As never before, people are experience themselves as separate. A lot of that's for good, jolly good thing. But we have to find a way beyond that that is constructive, creative, because if it's not gone beyond, I don't like the look of the future. So I think this language of sangha, and of intentional friendship rather than neighbourhood friendship or family friendship achieves a new importance in these much more highly fragmented and segmented circumstances we find ourselves in. And Bhante's special sort of attention to that, which is significant in that light. It's actually fairly common now amongst modern Buddhist groups, some sort of discussion along these lines. As so often, Bhante's been the first egg out of the chick. No, chick out of the egg, not egg out of the chick. Chick out of the egg. He's seen things that other Buddhists have gradually come to see. But you do see it amongst other Buddhists. They're realising that the language of Sangha needs new articulation. I find this really exciting, that we have to create new forms because we live in such radically different times, inspired by what our ancestors have done, our Buddhist ancestors have done. But we can't do it the same way in any sense. And, as a child of these times, I find that exciting, if you see what I mean, because that's part of our zeitgeist, whatever you call it in Holland and Dutch. What would it? Zeitgeist. Forgive my pronunciation. That's part of the mood of the times, is creativity, creation, new discovery. It's very interesting. I gave a talk in Budapest. It's a wonderful occasion. It's translated by a gypsy to an audience of mainly what the gypsies call Hungarians, which means white people. I'm a Hungarian. After I gave a talk about Karma and Dhamma and Niyamas, this is my theme at the moment, and I talked about the way in which Buddhism is transformative for deprived and excluded people. And afterwards somebody came to me and he said, it sounded to me as if what you're really talking about is democracy. And I was so pleased, because it seems to me that the notion of democracy is ultimately a spiritual principle. It has within it, you know, depths that the normal democratic discussion does not, discussion within democracy just doesn't bring out. This is, of course, a Baba Saheb, Dr. Ambedkar point, that democracy is an ideal, not a means of forming a government. So I think there's, you know, it's to do with a new mode of social relationship, which the Dhamma gives a depth and a clarity to.
Of course, democracy is an ideal.
Dr. Ambedkar, he said that people think of democracy as a way of choosing a government. He said, no, it's a state of mind, and it's an attitude of one citizen for another, an attitude of reverence and respect of one citizen for another. That when you enter into a democracy in the right spirit, you regard all your fellow citizens as with respect. You respect their freedom to participate in society. He based democracy on the principle of fraternity. You know, he had this, what to us seems rather quaint, evocation of liberty, equality and fraternity, which he said he derived not from the French Revolution, but from my master, the Buddha. He talked of democracy being founded in fraternity, bandhutva in Hindi. Fraternity, he said, is founded in maitri, in metta.
I don't know what fraternity means.
Huh? Fraternity, well, brotherhood, to be brotherhood stroke sisterhood, if you see what I mean. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. So here you are. This is a centre for the development of radical democracy. In the Metta Vihara, you're teaching people to enter into a truly fraternal relationship with others. This is what, in India, I teach the Metta Bhavna, saying that this is revolutionary. It's revolutionising your relationships with other citizens. So Dr. Ambedkar, I think, is a very profound and relevant thinker in these sort of respects. Vasika has asked me to give a talk on liberty, equality and fraternity in Paris. I'm not sure I've got the courage. I feel my neck a little. Yeah, I know. Yes, I feel hear the tumbrils rolling.
Actually, it's almost 5 o'clock.
You're going to cut me off with a guillotine.
Yeah, yeah. Just wanted to know whether we will invite Subhuti to go on rambling in this very, really inspiring way. We switch to our meditation in a few minutes.
I don't know if there are more questions you want to ask. We could.
But don't dare. Don't dare to do
that. You can ask a question.
Yeah. If you have to ask a question.
Really want to. Yeah. Because I think we need a 5 minutes of leg stretching.
Yeah, definitely.
So if there's someone who has a very burning question, it's really important that you have the time to ask that question now.
I can ask it on the way back in the car. So.
Wow, so we cannot listen to
I'll ask it then.
Yeah.
So short answer is probably not possible, but I was
thinking, I never give short answers.
No. You know that what you said this morning becomes, well, in many ways it moved me to tears because, you know, this whole thing about the Bodhisattva ideal, I'm not clear whether it's a question or whatever it is,
yeah.
But, you know, you've got the Bodhisattva ideal and the Arahant, and then, you know, you and Menti seem to sort of translate it again in a way that somehow this morning it made more sense.
Yes, yeah, yeah,
than
yeah, yeah.
The whole of my involvement in Sri Lanka. In terms of, you know, finding my total response, the total response from me towards either the Arahant or either the Bodhisattva ideal. It's not that I didn't have a response.
No.
But, so I don't know what my question is, but it's something about, for me, it seems to be the importance again, a bit like, you know, I know there's a few people have come back into the movement because of Dhammaketa's recent book. You know, he's really translated Benti's vision and the Buddha's vision into here, now, Western thinking, Western vision.
Yes.
So the thing that you communicated this morning seemed to me almost like, well, for me, as if for the first time I can respond completely.
Right, I can understand that, yeah.
As if there must have been bits of me which couldn't relate, whether it was the words or the tradition it came from, or my limitations, or the concepts I made of it, or how I interpret it, but it seems... as if you're, oh, I don't know.
Yeah, I got you.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I thought it was important.
Yeah. What I think came out from the set of conversations that I wrote up as revering and relying upon the Dhamma was a presentation that Bhante gave, which, the way I put it, is empirical. It refers to experience rather than to a theory. Or a model, however beautiful and however inspiring, that does not relate immediately. You have to work to relate it to experience. So that the model of its conditioned co-production, working in different kinds of laws, which you see worked out in terms of dharma and karma and dhamma niyama. So this is the way I think the releasing mechanism is. We can understand what the Bodhisattva means. We can understand what the Arahat means, but we don't have to get caught up in that old polemic. There isn't really a separate Arahat ideal or a separate Bodhisattva ideal. There can't be, because it's a question of setting up the conditions for the arising of a state of mind that transcends self-clinging. What then emerges from that is something spontaneous, which goes even more beyond self-clinging. So within that, you both ideals are sort of unified. So I think it's this referring back to empirical experience, maybe not our experience, or maybe only partly our experience. And I think that's the important thing that Bhante did through that set of discussions. He said, well, this is what I really think. Yes, it's not that I don't think these other things, but they are to be seen in the light of this. What he challenged me to do on Thursday, a week ago, was to then relate that back to early Buddhist tradition. Because there's such a strong emphasis in early Buddhist tradition on the, as it were, spiritual death side of things, not so much on the spiritual rebirth. I'm not myself completely convinced that's the whole story, but I'm going to reflect on that. And a lot of people say that, of course, there's so much lost. Anyway, I think you're... I think that that's what we are talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe on that very vague note we can finish.
Well, it relates a bit to what Sarojini, when you were talking to Sarojini about the emotional understanding.
Yes, yeah.
It seems to play sort of
Yeah, so really what I've realised is that spiritual death and spiritual rebirth are only emphases in a regular steps formula, if you see what I mean. But really, they're not at all different. You can't have spiritual death without spiritual rebirth. You can't have spiritual rebirth without spiritual death. Spiritual death without spiritual rebirth is nihilism. It's seeing that everything is completely... I think that's expressive enough. And spiritual rebirth without spiritual death is eternalism. There needs to be both, and this is the genius of the Dhamma. Bus.
Thank you very much.
Good.
I'm sorry you can go on rambling for 4 hours.
I can ramble forever, but we probably should also generate metta towards the entire universe. Yeah.
Thank you very much for it. Thank you. Then we have 5 minutes.
Good.
Next question.
Good.